All right. Hello, everyone. Apologies for the late start. We had some technical difficulties on our side, but let's kick things off right now. So my name is Mirza, and I will be hosting the seminar today instead of Bilal. This is going to be a special webinar on the macro and market implications of Trump 2.0. On our panel, we'll have Dominique to talk about macro implications, and Viresh and myself to, for our take on foreign exchange and commodities markets. These are early days, and I'm sure we'll have more to say once we get closer to the elections. But if you have any questions as we go through the webinar, please feel free to type them out in the chat. Now, everybody knows that the US elections are going to be an extremely important event, but it's not a huge focus right now. Markets can only focus on one or two things at a time. And right now, we get more questions about the June FOMC and the ECB meeting than anything else. But once the Trump trial is concluded and the Democratic National Convention is done in mid-August, we think that the attention will probably switch a lot more towards trading the US elections. So how do we do that? Well, to kick things off, I wanted to compare how the markets and economy look right now compared to when Trump was first elected in November 2016. Conventional wisdom says that the Trump trade is a pro-reflation trade. So stocks, rates, dollar commodities will all be higher if he wins. But look, the starting points are very different. In fact, on almost every metric, the US economy right now is more reflated and more fiscally stimulated than is probably sustainable. So the classic formulation of the Trump reflation trade isn't very obvious to us at this point in time, not to mention the fact that the first time that Trump won, it was a surprise, whereas now it's at least an even probability. So how can we help you? We did some analysis into what might change in response to specific trademark Trump policies, including crackdown on immigration, raising import tariffs, canceling the Inflation Reduction Act, and challenging Fed's independence. So to let's to break that down, let's start with Dominique. Dominique, if you could just switch your video on, please. Thank you very much, Dominique. So very quickly, Dom, could you please tell us, what is your election tracker telling us right now about what to expect from the election outcome, both for Congress and the White House?
Basically, the Republican win everything. Trump is leading both in the polls and in the betting markets. The Senate is very likely to turn Republican simply because of the composition of the third of Senate seats that are up for re-election, very strong consensus of pollsters, and the House seems more likely than not to remain Republican.
Got it. Thanks very much, Dom. And let's turn the clock back a little bit. What do you think the first Trump presidency meant for the economy? Just in macro terms, forget about markets, but what do you think it actually meant for the economy? Let me just put your slides up as well.
Very little, because the scale of what was done was relatively small, and the macro backdrop, as you just explained, was much more benign than it is now. So, for instance, the tariff. So Trump imposed about 80 billion of additional tariff on 380 billions of goods. There were some detailed academic studies looking product by product on the impact on prices and on unemployment and on employment. And the studies showed two things. One, there was a one-to-one impact on wholesale prices, but a bit less on retail prices. So in other words, retailers absorb some of the cost increases. Now, that is at the product level. At the macro level, as you can see on the on this slide, on the left-hand side, there was no impact on inflation. Why? Because the impact, the tariffs implied only a small share, well, about 15% of goods import. Also, goods account for about 25% of core PC weights. And most importantly, what we had was an increase in the price level not in the rate of change of price, which is what is inflation. And the reason is we were in what the BIS called a low inflation regime, and I'll explain a bit more later. But basically, no discernible macro impact in terms of inflation. In terms of manufacturing employment, it's pretty much the same thing. So there was, again, an academic study, a very detailed study, and it showed that the impact of the tariff on the protected industry was zero, on the protected industry employment was null. But there was retaliation by China on agricultural export, and there was a negative impact. And if you look at the macro data, it's roughly consistent with this view. On the right-hand side, I'm showing you manufacturing employment, and you can see that after the Trump tariff, it's flat. There was a slight increase during 2017-18, and from 2019 onwards, it flattens out. But what the academic study, which is very detailed and convincing, found is that in districts where there were industries that were impacted by the Trump tariff, even though employment in these industries did not increase, support for the Republican Party went up. So that, I think, is the story of the Trump tariff, something the voters like, even if it, makes no sense. And so Trump is doubling down. And this time around, we are talking about serious money. So one of the issues with figuring out, what will be the impact of a Trump presidency is that he's not a very systematic and disciplined policy maker. So we have a list of things, which, by the way, has kept growing through the campaign. So I'll give you what we've heard so far, but the number of tariff measures could go up. So we have 10% tariff on all imports, 60% tariff on imports from China, 100% tariff on imported cars. Then we would have this, by the way, can be taken without Congress, can be implemented without Congress approval. Then there would be a Trump Reciprocal Trade Act that would be voted by Congress. And the idea is that when a country has a higher tariff on some goods than the US has, the president could decide to raise the US tariff on that country's goods. Then
So,
the
Dom, sorry to interrupt. I mean, all of that sounds really significant for an economy which is at full employment, using immigration to plug labor gaps. Inflation's
Sure.
already very high. Or would your message be that this is going to be similar to last time, that in the end, all these Trump policies didn't have much impact? Or do you think there'll be much more impact this time?
There will be much more impact, not just because of the higher costs, but also because of the risk of a big negative supply shock, because that's not all. There is also talk of a sort of a Plaza number two agreement, where there would be a concerted depreciation of the dollar. Even some talk by your favorite author, Mirza, Mr. Lighthizer, of imposing capital controls. So, in its best form, we have an increase in cost. In its worst form, we have a regulatory environment that becomes very unpredictable and a negative supply shock. So this could be highly inflationary, because not only we are in a situation where, if you can move to the next slide, where, as you said, we already have resource pressure on the US economy, but we are also, in my view, in what the BIS calls a high inflation regime, where economic agents are very worried about inflation, and any inflationary signal gets quickly transmitted to the whole price structure. So, for instance, we are in a regime where the correlation between energy and core inflation is high precisely because energy is a key inflationary signal. So if people see suddenly the price of cars go up by God knows, this will be a 100% tariff on imported cars, means that domestic producer will have more pricing power. So cars go up by 20%, people are going to expect that inflation is rebounding. The other thing is, if a Trump administration went ahead with a dollar depreciation, in the 1990s, the Plaza Accord really interrupted the disinflation process. This is what I'm showing on the right-hand side. Where the orange line is core PC and the blue line is a dollar index, a trade-weighted dollar index. And you can see very, very fast disinflation until basically the Plaza Accord and the huge dollar depreciation. There was a rebound in inflation and then inflation. Disinflation resumed, but at a slower pace. So, given where we are, the risk of an increase in inflation is very significant. I also would like to
When
say.
I look at the second chart, I see that the relationship between inflation and the dollar comes and goes. Could you tell me like more about, which is more impactful in your mind, like curbs on immigration, and what would be the impact of that, or tariffs, and what would be the impact? Which of these policies do you consider to be a lot more meaningful from the inflation perspective?
So immigration, in my view, is supporting, we're talking about large-scale undocumented immigration. In my view, it's supporting growth and inflation because I think it's one of the reasons housing inflation is stuck. And for sure, it's helping to keep wage growth low, but that has not prevented a recovery in services inflation, which in my view is reflecting the monopolistic nature of the US economy. So in other words, the lower wages are being passed on to profits rather than to consumers through slower price increases. So in my view, the impact of inflation of immigration on inflation, it's probably a small net positive. So the tariff and the risk that we have chaos, basically, meaning a very unpredictable regulatory environment, these are much greater risks to inflation, than immigration.
Thank you very much, Tom. And so let's say you get that shock to inflation. What does the Fed do?
The Fed has no choice. They have a mandate, stable inflation and maximum employment. Employment is definitely maxed out. They've defined inflation at 2%. We are close to 3%. If inflation goes up, they will have to hike.
And finally, you also wrote a lot about the fiscal policy and the impact on issuance of bonds. I mean, we already know that the US fiscal policy is on a pretty unsustainable trajectory. What does Trump do to that?
So
Think you have some charts here.
again, there is a great deal of uncertainty. He has said he wants to extend the tax cut under his first tax cut law, so the TCJA, Tax Cut and Job Act of 2017. Some of those the tax cut expire at the end of next year. Extending them would cost extending them over 10 years would cost about 3.3 trillion, according to the CBO. So this is 12% of current GDP. So we're talking about big money. So the question is, do they offset with cut in expenditures? And we have no clear message from the campaign. But I think what is important for our listeners to keep in mind is that the deficit is already at close to 6%. If you want to get faster growth from a fiscal policy, you need to raise the deficit further, which means that issuance that is already at a high, this is the highest issuance relative to GDP outside of recessionary period. This means that issuance is going to go up. So That, in my view, creates a risk that long-term yields could go up, especially if we have a dispute between the Fed and Trump, if the Fed tries to do its job, which is to stabilize inflation. And based on the experience of the first Trump administration, it's very likely that we will have this dispute.
A lot, Dom. Just going back on the Fed, we've got a question. What level of Fed funds rate do you see under Trump tariffs? So let's say Trump goes ahead with the 60% on China, with the reciprocal tax. Let's leave the universal basic tariff out of it, but let's take those as your base case. And then, what do you think that does to the Fed funds rate?
We could go. We could have easily 150 basis points higher Fed funds next year. Let's say over the next the first 18 months of the Fed presidency. I mean, it's really hard to calibrate because it depends on the timing of the implementation. On what they actually do. So, but roughly, this is what we could be talking about, which, by the way, is consistent with my earlier call
We do come full circle, don't we?
27. So we're getting there. It's just taking a little longer than I thought it
Yeah, the
would.
destination, not the journey that matters, eh?
Exactly.
Finally, like, how would that happen though? Just like final question from you, Dom. Like, it just in terms of Fed independence, and given the fact that Trump is a low interest rates man and wants a strong economy, and then high interest rates are probably going to do some damage. How do you think that plays out in terms of Fed independence? Do you think there is a scenario in which the Fed ends up like that you have fiscal dominance?
So, I mean, the way it's going to work is that the Fed, there is very little Trump can do to the Fed decision making in the short run. The Fed is not funded by Congress. It's funded by the spread on its portfolio of securities. Fed governors are appointed for staggered terms of 14 years. Powell's mandate is up for renewal in May of 2026. One of the Governor Kugler, is up for renewal in January 2026. So it's likely that Trump would push through people who would be, supportive of his policies, but that will take time. I mean, nothing will happen until 2026, until Powell is replaced, basically.
Got
So
it.
yes, there is a medium-term risk to the Fed independence, but not right away.
Thank you very much, Dom. We're going to let you go now. And let me just talk a little bit more about the tariff man, because we're obviously talking about tariffs. If you could just switch your video off, Dom, thank you very much. So this is a time-honored tweet. Are you all on Truth Social yet? If not, and if Trump wins, probably going to have to activate your account. I think it's also worth pulling out the interview that Trump did with CNBC in March. He was surprisingly coherent and candid in his stance on tariffs. And I think some of the snippets that I've pulled out here don't do full justice to us because he said a lot more than this. But it does tell you he is still the tariff man. So that's the bottom line. Like, we should not discount what he has said about his plans. To increase tariffs on China, to increase tariffs on the world, and to have reciprocal taxes. Most of this can be done without legislation. Lighthizer did use the Section 301 clause against China. The US has also crippled the WTO's complaint mechanism by blocking appointments to judges. So most of this can be done. So let's quickly take a look back to what tariffs achieved during his first presidency. Did it change the US deficit? Did it narrow the US deficit? No, but it spread it out. So it squeezed it out of China and spread it out to other countries. And the chart on the left kind of like shows this, which shows the bilateral deficit that the US runs versus each of those countries. The percentages is how much of that country runs a percentage of. So in 2017, the US was running 35% of its deficit with China, and that's down to 25%, but it's up 300% versus Canada, 200% versus Taiwan, 100% versus Mexico and 35% versus the Eurozone. So, and the overall deficit is larger in dollar terms. So effectively, instead of China now being the counterpart to the deficit, now a lot of these other French-owned countries have become the counterparts. So, so the second chart kind of like plots that. So you've got Chinese deficit has gone from, say, 400 billion to 250, but for the French-owned countries, it's gone from 200 to 450. And that's what's happened. Looking at this from a different perspective, so US share of China's exports has also gone down. So for China, the US has become less important as an export destination from over 20% to like under 15% now. Whereas the current share of US imports from other countries has increased quite sharply, in particular from Mexico, Vietnam, Canada, and some of the other Asian economies. Excuse me. All right, so how do you trade tariffs? If he's going to go after China, so we should just buy dollar China, right? I'd say yes and no. Yes, because China devalued the RMB roughly in proportion to the effective import tariff that the US imposed during 2018 to 2019. And because they're doing so again, 2 weeks ago, the Biden administration put like they quadrupled tariffs on Chinese EVs, solar, and batteries. That was on a very small portion of trade. The total trade for that is less than $30 billion. But last Friday, the Biden administration also removed exemptions on tariffs for about 70 odd billion dollars worth of trade as well. These exemptions were granted before and were extended by Biden in December last year. But last Friday, they removed those exemptions, effectively raising the import tariff on about $60 to $70 billion worth of trade. And I think that's the main reason why the PBOC has allowed dollar China to go higher this week. Yes, broad dollar is higher, but we've had periods where the dollar did go higher, but dollar China was held flat. But I find it quite interesting that the Chinese currency is reacting to actions taken by the Biden administration on tariff exemptions. So the model still works. And I don't think this is some nefarious, calculated ploy by the Chinese authorities. I would argue that this is a market-driven process. For example, the pound fell about 20% after the Brexit vote, and stayed there, partly because of anticipation of higher import tariffs. Barry Eichengreen's book on the Great Depression is also full of examples of how tit-for-tat tariffs led to corresponding FX devaluations for currencies that were not on the gold standard. So I would think that FX will once again be sensitive to tariffs. And if tariffs on China are raised, then dollar China will have some reaction to that as well. I did say yes and no. So why no? Well, I think it's partly because the Chinese have prepared for it. Firstly, as this chart shows, that US as a share of Chinese exports is much smaller. We've done some research to see what China has done to achieve that, and China has effectively diversified its export base quite substantially to the global south, which would not be affected by these tariffs. So effectively, the proportion to which the Chinese must devalue the currency has gone down, and we expect that's probably a significant and structural change that's happened. And the second is that the RMB is already very competitive and undervalued. We all hear about deflation in China, but as a consequence of running much lower inflation than the rest of the world, Chinese manufacturing companies have effectively gained competitiveness. From COVID to now, I estimate just the difference in CPI between the US and China, which is used to deflate currencies to establish purchasing power parity. Well, on that basis alone, China's gained about 15% competitiveness. And if you do the full PPP model, would you believe? The RMB right now is more undervalued than it was before they depegged in 2005 when they were pegged at 828. So in real terms, the RMB is more undervalued than when spot was at 828 and pegged to the dollar in 2005. And I think all of those things do provide a lot of cushion to Chinese manufacturers to be able to absorb a higher tariff rate without necessarily having a correspondingly large currency devaluation. So I would expect that the beta of dollar China to tariffs is probably much lower now, even though the reaction will probably be the same. Next, let me turn to our scenario analysis. And I would say that this is just a thought process. I wouldn't say that Trump thinks in terms of structured scenarios. I think it's quite likely that he will shift between scenarios depending on which way he's getting the more traction. So he might start off by going specifically against China. And then he might say, okay, who else do we run a deficit with? And then go after those countries. And then again, have policies that kind of like take a reciprocal tax as a broad umbrella for all countries. And I would say that the Trump presidency will blow hot and cold between these scenarios, but this is more of a way to structure our thinking. And I would say a really good scenario for, what we might get away with in terms of impact on global tariffs would be that the tariff war remains confined to China. So a 60% rise in Chinese import tariffs without a huge other, without some of the other policies being followed through upon. And I think what that would do is that it would just accelerate the trends that we've already had in terms of reshoring out of China into French shores. And in terms of market impact, I would say that would continue to support the very popular trades that are in the market right now, which is long Mexico versus China, long India versus China, both of which economies are benefiting a lot from the relocation of manufacturing from China. So this is the good scenario, which the market is already, I feel, positioned for and probably going to be quite happy if this is how it plays out. The more sort of bad or middle scenario, which maybe should be our base case, if anything, would be where you get a 60% import tariff on China, but then also in addition to that, a 10% universal basic tariff on the rest of the world as well. And this is kind of this goes back to the scenario which Dom was talking about, whereas it would probably have some impact on inflation, given the fact that we are already in a high inflation regime. It would most likely increase global stagflationary risks. And what would it do to the dollar? Well, my argument would be that in the first instance, the dollar will go higher, and it will go higher as a response to risk aversion, so the right-hand side of the dollar smile. But also because that's what foreign exchange does. As I argued before, when tariffs go up, currencies react to negate the impact of those tariffs. And I would argue that a 10% tariff on all US export partners or trade partners would probably lift the dollar by roughly the same amount, all else being equal. Things would get a lot more ugly, though, and that would be where other countries start to also retaliate, and you get a lot of tit-for-tat reactions, especially with other countries and, raising tariffs on the US and then Trump raising even more. So kind of like a one-upping process. Now, I doubt things will get as bad as that. Surely we've learned the, lessons from the Great Depression, but we could approach two or three rounds of these, tit-for-tat tariffs. And the region that could be hurt the most from this would be the trade-dependent region of Asia. And I would say that that would be the scenario where it's not just dollar China, but all Asian currencies that could devalue significantly, because what we'd be looking at would be a breakdown of the global order on trade, which is something which Asia completely relies upon. So let me stop here. I see there's some questions coming through, but let's go through Viresh's part of the presentation first, and then I'll come back to the questions at the end. Meantime, if you do have any questions, please continue to go ahead and type those in. Viresh, so what did, from your perspective, Trump's first presidency look like for oil, let's say?
Yeah, no, hey Mirza, hey everyone. So yeah, no, it's worth going through what Trump's first presidency looked like, as you said, to get an idea of what his second presidency might look like. So in terms of policies, there were really three things he did. Two were by executive order, and then the third was just after COVID. So the first two things occurred in May 2019. So there were executive orders first to prevent states from blocking energy projects. So this is related to the Clean Water Act, where certain states have the power to stop pipeline expansions in their region if they think it'll impact water quality. And then the second one was executive order to cancel offshore drilling safety measures. And the idea here was to reduce the burden and cost the cost constraints on oil firms to encourage further drilling. The third measure came in August 2020, as I said. This was to rescind methane flaring rules for pipelines. So what this tells you is these three policies were mainly aimed at improving the ease of doing business and reducing the cost burden for energy producers. So it's not directly aimed at increasing production per se. It's just those second degree measures helping remove the restrictions from doing so. I'd also like to highlight what the oil market looked like the first time around, because there are a few important changes to think about. So the first thing was in 2017, and you can sort of see the highlighted region in the chart. The biggest change that occurred was the forming of the new OPEC Plus. So this was with Russia, and they were aiming to put a floor under the oil price at $60 on Brent. And you can see they implemented a series of cuts in 2016 before he came into power, and then again in 2018 and 2019 when they're aiming to defend the oil price falling below their sort of floor. Interestingly, these cuts were actually in response to Iranian sanctions at the time. And also, it's worth noting that Trump was tweeting about how high oil prices were throughout 2018 and the pressure that they were putting on consumers. So it's not necessarily that just because he's increasing or he's helping reduce the burden for production, it's necessarily going to be attractive for oil producers to invest, because oil prices might not actually be high enough. The second thing to really highlight is this game-changing narrative that the oil producers themselves have gone through. So back then, oil producers were still focused on drill, baby, drill, which is this notion that they're maximizing for production rather than profits. You know, today the world looks very different and they swear by a different religion, one where capital discipline is more important and increased capex really relies on higher oil prices, i.e. they're maximizing now for return on capital employed rather than production. And we've also seen a large amount of M&A within the oil industry as well, which means there's fewer private producers who are flexible enough to increase production and capex without the pressure of shareholders getting on their back. So did these policies have an impact? Mirza, if you could just turn to the next slide. I think they did, but it's not clear how much. So chart two shows that we did see an increase in the rig count during Trump's term. So I just look at the change in average rig count during the final 24 months of each presidency here. So it allows for policies to come in place, have an impact, and then take an average. But it's not significant. The real increase really came during Obama's first presidency and at the start of his second presidency. And you can also think that Trump benefited from an OPEC put during his term. And when you look at oil production, you know, it was definitely strong. But again, a lot of the benefits here were maybe out of his control rather than directly related to him. So I think, you know, the oil market's a big market. There's a lot of things going on. So on the margin, maybe had an impact, but very limited. In the grand scheme of things.
Girish, so let me switch back to this chart, and I love the range that you've put here. Is that like a $70-$80 kind of a range, which is some sort of an assumed floor price for based on OPEC control of the market? Is that the inference here?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly right. So the second range that I've used is what I think of as Saudi Arabia's revealed preferences. So this is what every time they've cut since COVID has been to defend the $80 Brent mark. And we put out some research a couple of weeks back just explaining why that's the case and the fiscal background behind that. But what that tells you is, you know, not only are Saudi Arabia defending the $80 mark, but actually US producers aren't increasing significantly if oil prices are around that level.
So let's take that. So what do you think would be the Trump policies that will help production increase, and how much production would we need to increase for this channel to be no longer under control of Saudis? Like, what would be the downside risk from this price? We know that Trump wants to increase oil production. So I guess what I'm asking you is, like, how will he do it? And how much would be needed to create a new zone on this chart?
Sure. So let's go to the policies first. So if you could just turn to the third slide. And I'll come back to the second part of that soon. So really, I've just highlighted the main policies that I think he could implement to impact oil production. And you know, these will have varying impacts. So I won't really discuss the first and second, but really it's the third and fourth that we need to focus on. So the third one, which I've highlighted there, is accelerating the permitting process for drilling offshore, so near the Gulf of Mexico and also in the Permian. So this is really important because right now, the Biden administration takes about 18 months to provide a response on new drilling permits. And then the second one is allowing exploration in Alaska. So for context, Alaska has almost 3.2 billion barrels of proved reserves. So this, you know, this is the third or fourth highest in the US. However, most of this region is protected by environmental constraints. So there's actually very little activity going on. And as a result, oil production has fallen over time. So, you know, what impact? So, say we had all four of these come to pass within the first year of his presidency. So, unlikely, but you know, say that's your base case. Well, the first thing you have to consider is actually the time it takes to go from approval to exploration to drilling and production and then sort of pipeline transfer. You know, that process can take 12 to 18 months. And there's been a number of sort of extraordinary technological improvements in the Permian. But, you know, we should still have this base case where even where we'd see these policies going through, there's limited impact in the first 24 months. It's really only beyond that where you start to see an impact. So now coming back to
Okay.
your question, which was, you know, what, you know, how much production increase could we get? You know, how could that impact the Saudi put? My answer is, you know, my response is this. Number one, we're already at the sort of limits of how far production can be cut whilst growth is still strong. And the reason for
Okay.
this is that we're seeing OPEC members continually increase and invest in maintaining spare capacity. So you know, you can't be continually investing in production capacity but not have the revenues coming in to use it. So if we see an increase of, say, 500,000 barrels in the second half of his presidency, 500,000 barrels and above, that's a real game changer because that really swings
Okay.
supply and demand balances.
So OPEC has limited appetite for further cuts because they've been expanding their capacity. And if the US expands capacity by 500,000 barrels, then OPEC loses control of the market. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I think that at that stage, we'll start to see more pressure coming on price. And
Right.
then we'll see more pressure coming on OPEC because then a, you know, being forced to make further cuts,
Right.
which will be seen as extremely, you know, that's something that they don't want to do. Especially, you can already
Right.
see the pressure that they're in under right now. So
Right.
that's
But I
why.
also heard you say that you don't expect that the US producers will react just to a change in policies by ramping up production to by 0.5 million barrels per day.
That's right. So
Right.
this is really the key takeaway, which is
Okay.
if this was 4 years ago, or if this was 5 years ago, capital discipline wasn't a thing. We had significantly more private producers. Then yes, these policies could be more effective. Today,
Okay.
that's not the case. And you know, we've got a large number of small, we've got a
Okay.
small number of large producers, making it less likely.
Thanks, Paresh. Let's change tack a little bit. Trump has also talked about repealing the Inflation Reduction Act. What do you think about that? What does that do?
Sure. So if you turn over to the next slide, I've just highlighted the two main areas where I think he can have an impact. So really he's aiming to sort of impact supply and demand, right? So on the demand side, he could remove a $7,500 tax credit that you receive when buying an eligible EV. And on the supply side, he could reduce the subsidy that OEMs get when they produce you know, a certain degree of fuel efficient vehicle. So this would be hybrids and EVs on the in this case. So there's really a couple of impacts I'd highlight here. So the first is, you know, the aim of these policies is actually on the demand side of oil. And the reason for that is because it would help sustain gasoline demand, whereas most forecasters see US gasoline demand falling over time from here on, led by this sharp uptake on EVs. I mean, we're already seeing that narrative sort of struggle, but you know, if you remove subsidies on the demand side, I really think that comes under pressure. So you don't, you know, gasoline demand stays stronger for longer. That's takeaway number one. Takeaway number two is actually on the metal side. So the average EV uses about two times more copper than an ICE vehicle. While it also reduces the demand for battery metals such as cobalt and aluminium, which are sort of heavily in demand as well. So we forecast that, you know, in a base case right now, US copper demand could grow by 7% from here over the next 4 years. And if there is sort of this big repeal in IRA policies, copper demand will actually halve. So rather than increasing by 7%, it increases more like 3 to 3.5%. And you know, the main source of growth there would be more on the grid side, which is more important than the sort of EV side. So that also means something for trade ideas. So the last Trump presidency was bullish for the copper to gold ratio. So we saw yields rise, copper to gold rise. Whereas this time, I think it could be the opposite. So we see gold demand being strong due to deglobalization. We see copper demand being weak due to Trump's policies. And it also could mean something where metals such as platinum benefit too, which is a sort of a large input into ICE vehicles. So you could have an interesting trade where you'd be long gold and platinum against something like copper in the event of his presidency coming in play. And that would be a complete 360 to what we saw last time.
Interesting. Do you think that that's a trade? Because I know you're already recommending that. So do you think we're already at that point where you should put it on? Or do you think we need to see a little bit more to see a change in that ratio?
Yeah, no, good question. So the main thing I would think of is, as you said, the market's not really focused on a Trump presidency right now. And copper is having its own sort of idiosyncratic issues, which is what more what my trade idea was focused on. I would say, you know, wait until we're closer to the election.
Right.
As soon as we see the polls moving, markets moving to reflect that, that's when this sort of trade might start working. And more importantly, the largest moves actually occurred after he was in power, or once he was nominated. So I think that's when the biggest moves will happen, and when you should start putting that trade on.
Okay, interesting. That definitely challenges the conventional view. I think the conventional view would be that when Trump is in, more reflation, copper is a reflationary metal, so copper will go higher. But I think what you've clarified is that the removal or repeal of the IRA Act will actually reduce copper demand, and from a different angle, support gold prices because of other policies such as tariffs and so on. And that could actually flip the ratio the other way. Perfect.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Viresh. Thanks for that. I did want to go over a couple more questions we've received, but we have limited time. Maybe just go through one more. Dom, this one's for you, I think. The question the client is asking is, like, you know, we're saying how bad Trump might be for inflation, for immigration, for Fed policy, for Fed independence. But do you expect any positives from a second Trump presidency?
So I can see three potential positives, actually, all the reverse of what you just said. On immigration, the Trump campaign tells us that besides securing the border, they want an immigration reform, and that the US badly needs. We need skills-based immigration a la Australia or Canada. That's in the campaign program. I will be the first one to applaud if the Republicans get it through Congress. So that could be very positive. Another positive, again, reading the campaign program, is tightening the Fed mandate. There is a discussion of the mission creep of the Fed going into issues such as climate change, inequalities, and that you really see with the research agenda of the regional Fed, not the board in Washington, D.C. You see this mission creep. I think it's totally legitimate to tighten their mandate. I would hope that if the Republicans have complete control of Congress, that they would be more ambitious with Fed reform. To give you a sense of how inefficient the Fed is, it was founded in 1914. Missouri, so we have 12 regional Federal Reserve Bank. Missouri, a state that you probably don't spend a lot of time thinking about, has two Feds, while the West Coast of the United States has a single one. Then there is the issue of the transparency in the appointments of the regional Fed president. For instance, the New York Fed president is a permanent member of the FOMC. His confirmation process is not subject to congressional oversight. So there is a host of inefficiencies with the current Fed organization. In my view, it would be very beneficial to the US economy if a Trump administration would reform that. So that's my second potential positive. The third one, perhaps the biggest one, I would credit Trump with changing the content of the policy discussion. Before Trump, there was this sort of conventional view that free trade was good, was lifting all boats. It was absolutely not true. That's why we have Trump. And so I credit him for bringing this fact into the mainstream debate. I just don't think that a trade war is the way we are going to deal with the issues created by globalization.
Okay. Doesn't sound like you're going very far, though, Dom. So you think skills-based immigration would be a good thing. Administrative reforms of the Fed might be a good thing. And, you know, it's whatever he does might be the wrong way, but might be the right discussion to be having about trade and fair trade.
100%.
Okay,
Yeah.
all right. Okay, I notice we're out of time now. Thank you very much to our speakers, and thank you very much to the attendees, and we'll speak again next week. Goodbye.